And they were, the children were on the fifth floor with a containment building in Delhi of a slum. And they were working as bonded slaves. The kids were aged between 10 and 12. And they were working 16, 17 hour days. But the worst thing about the story was five floors below the sweatshop was a school. And this was the thing, this was the thing that really broke my heart. So every day they were working 16, 17 hour days. And for half of that day, listening to school children play and lessons and the cycle of life, the school bell, you know, the clanging bell that you have in India. Yeah.
Three-time Foreign Correspondent of the Year nominee, the UK equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize, a dozen major international prizes for reporting, including four Amnesty International Awards for Outstanding Human Rights Journalism, a Royal Television Society Award for Documentary Making, and a Martha Gellhome Prize nominee for War Reporting, Foreign Press Association of London Writer of the Year, and One World Journalist of the Year for Outstanding Foreign Reporting. These awards are testament to the talent and tenacity of Scottish-born journalist Dan McDougall. Dan was also voted one of the world's most influential people in the world of ethical trading by US-based Ethisphere Institute. He's also a visiting lecturer at Cambridge University on business and human rights and recently spoke at the United Nations in Geneva on the impact of corporate supply chains on the world's poorest. Not to mention, he's an ardent Glasgow Celtic fan and an all-round good guy. In this wide-ranging episode, we cover everything from the influence of his working-class upbringing in Glasgow, his early career in journalism, how serendipity changed his life during the 2005 tsunami, his curiosity and his ferocious desire to address child labour abuses in corporate supply chains, and his experiences as a war correspondent. I hope you enjoy this stimulating and uncompromising discussion with Dan McDougall.
Welcome to the Impossible Network, Dan.
Okay, thank you.
And I believe you are in Barcelona.
Yeah, we live in Barcelona now. We're based here. It's a really great city, a very creative place, and somewhere that we kind of agonized over moving to. It was either going to be Los Angeles, Lisbon, or Barcelona. And yeah, and so Barcelona won. I'm a huge football fan, of course. So to be here, you know, this is the home of football.
Well, we could get into a conversation that would take us down a completely different football podcast, but maybe we'll do that as a follow-up.
Yeah, another time.
But thanks for being on the show. So we tend to start with your upbringing. I'd love to learn a little bit more about your family, your social environment, and how that set you on your path to becoming an award-winning journalist and latterly content creator.
Well, I grew up in a housing estate called Foxbar, which sounds very kind of green and rural and pastoral, but it's not. It's the opposite. It's just a rather downbeat place. But I was happy there. I don't really struggle with this kind of concept of identity. I think Andrew Hagen writes beautifully about identity, Scott's author, and how having a strong sense of identity is a useful thing for a writer. I think there's a lot of writers would rather have kind of more of a messed up childhood, right? You know, they would more adversity and maybe that will give them some kind of material to draw on. But for me, growing up in Paisley was my family was split down the middle, half Catholic, half Protestant, which is quite a controversial mix. So I grew up in a very working class family. My father was a lorry driver.
Can I jump in there, Dan? Because you said, yeah. What I find interesting is that you came from a family of both Catholics and Protestants. It must require you to be somewhat empathetic to both sides of the family. Is that something you think may have actually contributed to your ability, being able to see both sides of an argument, to be able to talk to people wherever you go?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'd honestly like to say with my hand in my heart that, you know, when it comes to the green and blue of Glasgow, that I can see both sides and I have empathy, but no, it's the opposite. I'm a Celtic fan and was very drawn to the Catholic side of the family. I would be being dishonest if I said that the experience of growing up in a split family made me see both sides, because there was only one side for me. my mother's side, actually, ironically, maybe there is something in that. Maybe Oedipus could say something about that. I think certainly growing up in a Scots Catholic Protestant family is quite controversial in some respects. When my parents got married, my mum was only 20, 19 in fact. My dad was 19. They were just kids. They were teenagers, right? And down the aisle, and one side of the family on one side of the hall, the other on the other, it's ticking every cliched box. But I had a very, very large extended family in both sides. My father's from 7, my mother's from 8. It might be the other way around, brothers and sisters in terms of siblings. And obviously they had quite a bad experience in terms of coming into the relationship, because one Catholic, one Protestant. It's like Romeo and Juliet narrative in some respects. And so as a consequence, I think that what my parents did, and I don't think that they did it consciously, I think it just happened over time, is they almost corralled themselves off from the extended family and the pressures that that brings. And we became a very classic nuclear family in quite short order. So I was, as a consequence, brought up in this very protected and closeted world. You know, I would see my cousins and maybe every month or something, but we weren't living on top of each other, which is very true for a lot of families in the west coast of Scotland. And that's going to be something that I do think about increasingly, is that perhaps that was an advantage to me because I had this cocoon around me. So the first 11 years of my life, I was brought up as an only child, which my wife would probably say explains a lot. My sister is, you know, would say that I am an only child. She was born 11 years later. But I think that I certainly was very protected and very, very, my parents put a lot of focus on me, on my education, on my sport, on every aspect of my life. So I was, you know, I wasn't spoiled. We didn't have a lot of money, but I was very much loved. And every time I've gone for counselling, you know, for post-traumatic stress and other things, they really wanted to drill down and talk to me about my parents looking for evidence of a messed up childhood. It's just not there. I can't find anything. It's like,
what about your social environment? I mean, you say you had a closeted upbringing, being almost this only child for 11 years. That couldn't have been the same when you're going through school in the west coast of Scotland, being an ardent Celtic supporter.
No, I mean, I think, look, you know, socially, my entire interaction with the world was through football. You know, I was obsessed. Just played football. Like, I played for three different teams at the same time through my whole childhood. You know, I eventually made it as a trialist and obviously a number of Premier teams or Scottish Premier teams, and did pre-season with Hamilton Accies and then was found out. But, I was a very good amateur. But I think going back to this issue of my parents and working class roots, is my mum and dad worked in Coatsy's Mills, which is a cotton mill in Paisley that used to employ like 20,000 people. It employed half the town. I guess like in America, you have Chrysler and, you know, GM Motors, you know, basically is the economic backbone of all these towns. And it's the same in Scotland. It used to be the same in Scotland. You know, in Paisley, we had the motor plant in Linwood that the Proclaimers sing about in Letter from America.
British Leyland.
Linwood no more. And also, obviously, Coats. And so Coats, ironically, is distributed thread and wool all over the world. And my mum worked in the factory on the lines from a very young age, from 17 or so. She was a factory worker. Effectively, sweatshops, right? When you really think about it, and that might explain some later aspects of my life. My dad was a lorry driver. And he became a shop steward when I was very young, when I was 3 or 4, and was quite politicised. And I remember all the, you know, he'd sit in his lorry cab reading the Glasgow Herald. And anyone that grows up in Glasgow knows that your average lorry driver is sitting reading the Daily Record or the Sun or a tabloid, and he was reading the broadsheets and very engaged in politics. And he was obviously bright from a young age, but his economic circumstances were fairly dire, as were my mother's. And that's how they found each other. They lived across the road from each other in an area called Craigielea, Fergusley Park, which at that time, and was until the 80s, was probably one of the most deprived areas of Europe. And in fact, the most deprived area of Europe is a place called Scampia in Naples, where I did a story, investigation into to Roma travellers many years ago. That's a very dangerous place. Welcome to Scampia, and the snipers on the roof. It's controlled by the Camorra. And that's maybe a little bit like what Fergusley Park was like. So I guess that from an upbringing perspective, I was from a very early age, a father who had enormous intellectual potential, but through circumstance found himself working as a lorry driver.
But you said that he was quite political and he was a shop steward. Did he have a politicising effect on you?
He's a kind of quiet man, my dad. You know, he's got lots of opinions, political opinions. In fact, we disagree in quite a lot of things these days politically, but we still have the same core principles. But my grandfather on the Catholic side, my mother's side, was very, very vocal on politics. And at this time, the backdrop of our lives, my childhood, was Margaret Thatcher, right? She formed the spine of my entire political kind of existence. I mean, everything was negative about Whitehall politics, against establishment, against Scotland being marginalised, the closure of factories, heavy industries. I had family losing jobs. And by osmosis, this extreme political situation, this, I guess, malcontent across Scottish life seeped into my being. And I didn't know it at the time. I know it now, but I didn't know it at the time. And yeah, so I became very politicised from a very young age.
Just looking back in the Thatcher years, and I know it still divides people depending on what side of the Thatcher argument you stand, but there clearly was a period in Britain where there was a complete lack of social justice. Do you get a sense that that sense you have for righteousness and fighting for people that are trodden by either corporations or through ill-practiced supply chains, that instinct you have for social justice and for resistance was born through that, living through the Thatcher years?
I think the thing that annoyed me most about that period, I mean, I remember the teachers being on strike a lot, and I remember being upset because football was cancelled. Right, that was like the end of my world, right? And we would end up, teachers would just end up volunteering their own time. Parents would come in, the community would somehow keep the team going, but there was no overtime. The teachers working to rule or on strike, huge class sizes. And so, you know, there was definitely an impact in my daily life as a child. And I guess that would have fed an anger and a distrust of probably authority in some respects. I think that Thatcher remains a demon to many Scots of my generation and before. I mean, don't forget, right, that, you know, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead almost went to number one in Scotland when Thatcher died. I mean, they wanted that song to reflect. No, they didn't want her to have a state funeral. And I think a lot of people are still hurting from that. And I could certainly go through every one of my highly educated, successful working class friends, and they would all put her at the top of the list, you know, in terms of hate figure. And I do realise that's an emotional argument, because if I was to reflect on it with my education and my experience now, I would say that she was a very dogmatic character, and she was no fan of Scotland, but, you know, a lot of the policies that she introduced were probably, I hate to use the word prescient, but they probably were quite prescient in some respects. But she, you know, I don't know anyone whose lives weren't touched by the Conservative Party in a negative way in the 80s.
At that period, you were finishing school, entering university?
Yeah, I mean, I was the first member of my family to go to university.
So what sparked your interest in journalism?
It's going to sound contrite, but as a youngster, I was obsessed with Tintin, the comic book, the French comic book by Hergé. I mean, I know Hergé was a Nazi, right? It's not really fashionable to like Tintin. But for me, that life that he had, that experience was just... And ironically, Hergé was a recluse. He never went anywhere. So anyone that reads Tintin thinks that Hergé travelled the world. And he sat in an apartment in Brussels and just basically used research. And I had access to one thing that probably was a turning point for me, and it was the reference library in Paisley. I'd get into the reference library and I would look at Encyclopedia Britannicas, and I would look at maps. And they had these boxes full of old coins and all sorts of weird stuff. And for me, it was like I'd go on my own. And the way I think about it is actually, because I wasn't like an outlier or a geek or anything as a kid, right? I was like sporty and stuff. But why am I hanging about in a library looking at maps and, you know, old kind of encyclopedias from the colonial days and stuff? And one thing that Paisley did have because of Coates was that they'd been bequeathed as the most extraordinary public reference libraries, you know, like great museums, because the Coates family were philanthropic and they'd given all the books to the great unwashed, to the proletariat. And, you know, you go in and look at all these incredible library books. And that was probably a big influence on me. And I love it. I was an avid reader. But the journalism thing specifically comes from Tintin. And I felt maybe that chimed with this. He was always a crusading, campaigning human rights journalist, effectively. So that was specifically for the journalism aspect.
And where do you think your curiosity came from to find yourself in reference libraries? Do you think it's just a trait you've been born with, a natural curiosity?
I think so. I get asked quite a lot about this. I get asked about instinct normally, you know, where does that instinct come from? And yeah, maybe I can talk about that later. But yeah, I think that there is a natural curiosity. I mean, I loved reading poetry from a very young age, and still do, in fact. And I write poetry now, and I have done for some time. And so I've always had this love of poetry, almost as a form of protest. And I was very, as a young boy, I was guided by a teacher in my primary years who was obsessed with Robert Burns. And so in Scotland, Burns is part of, you know this, Mark, is Scotland, yeah. Burns is part of the curriculum, right? He's part of the bread and butter of education. And so I remember reading, you know, The Sere Finger, you know, I remember Tam O'Shanter, which is just a nightmare. Like, it was like, I don't even know how long Tam O'Shanter is, but it seemed to be the time, like, a bit, like a dissertation, you know?
It was like a curse for me when I was at school trying to remember that.
But, you know, I recently gave a Burns Night. I did the Immortal Memory, and Burns Night, for the listeners, is like you basically turn up and you get very drunk and eat haggis and celebrate the life of the great bard. And I did a lot of research into Burns' life, and I heard this Burns was a massive influence on me because I realise now in retrospect that he was actually like a human rights journalist. He was the kind of guy that would he would write a poem in praise of a family's meal. Just that, you know, he was a terrible philanderer and a bit of a drunk and he had lots of personal flaws, but he was an incredible writer. His poetry, his music, his prose is timeless even to this day. And when I was researching The Immortal Memory, I found a passage about his relationship with Maya Angelou. And so Maya Angelou had been sexually abused as a child and obviously grew up in effectively bonded slavery. Her family or extended family would be bonded slaves, and she had the most horrendous childhood. And the thing that echoed with her was Burns. She had was a missionary or a Scottish teacher, and when she read My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose, it suddenly brought her alive, you know, brought words, and it just somehow connected with her in a level that she couldn't explain, I don't think, throughout her life. One of the questions she said is, why was this white Scottish guy that lived 200-300 years ago, why has he connected with me above anyone else? And I can relate to that. Burns is not relevant to her life in lots of different ways, but once you start digging into the lyrics or the stanzas, you start to understand he's talking about modern life, you know, the struggles of the working class, the love, heartache, you know, all these incredible. And so that definitely inspired me to write, and from a very early age. Like I wrote my first feature when I was 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you what I wrote it about. I wrote it about Glaswegians going down the water, which means going down the water. So Glaswegians would go on holiday about an hour's boat journey from Glasgow, which is, you know, I suppose it's the Long Island and stuff like that. In New York, they do the same, yeah? Maybe back in the day.
Or up the Hudson.
Yeah, as simple as that, really. It's just, you know, where you can afford to go, which is normally quite close. I suppose these days they'd call it a staycation.
Yeah. I'm intrigued. So you had this natural talent, that interest in poetry, and probably a love for prose and for writing. But there had to be a leap that got you into journalism, and how did that sort of connect to the type of journalism that's defined your life and your career and your success?
I get asked a lot about what makes you a successful journalist. And one of the things I do now is I lecture at Cambridge in human rights, and I think that a lot of the students ask me where I get my ideas from, where do I find the stories. And in Scotland, you have a saying, which is which your grandmother would probably have said as well, is that you can't teach that. And it means you can't teach that. And if I was to be honest, if I was to think where my journalistic instinct comes from, I would say that it's something that can't be taught. It's something inherent. It's like if I was sitting in a cafe, I would hear something and that would trigger my curiosity. And that, by definition, would probably lead me somewhere to find the story. Not that I'm spying or eavesdropping on people, but I can smell a story. It's just pure instinct. The day that I became a journalist, my life changed forever, because I was always looking for stories. I became a tabloid journalist when I first started, and a successful one. I was a good tabloid journalist. A lot of people might have argued that I should have stayed a tabloid journalist because I was like a dog with a bone, you know, ferocious.
This is in Glasgow, something like the Daily Record.
Yeah, so I worked for Daily Record, we used to sell a million copies a day. I mean, it was one of the biggest newspapers in Britain, the real emblem of working class Scots. I mean, everyone had the Daily Record, right? And I don't know what the equivalent would be, the New York Post in the States.
It would be the New York Post.
And I just remember, you know, going into the newsroom for the first time, and they had the old printing presses there before they moved, and just what a newsroom is like is a very testosterone fueled environment. And you know, I was a young graduate, and I didn't really, when I went to Stirling University, I mean, you know, university, I was the first member of my family to go to university, but I generally regard it as a bit of a waste of time. And I was already a journalist, right? I mean, I was working night shifts at The Sun when I was at university, another newspaper, and I didn't need to go to university to learn to become a journalist, which is what I say to my own children. If you want to do something, start at 18. And I remember going into the newsroom and just being terrified. All these really gruff Scots, you know, crime correspondents, people that have been on the job for 30 years, ferocious characters, heavy drinkers, you know, like literally 4 or 5 pints of beer at lunchtime. And you know, a lot of them couldn't even function sober. They couldn't write without having 5 or 6 drinks. And that's the environment that you go into, you know, people trying to smoke in the office, even though they were trying to phase that out at that point. And the newspaper itself was the den of inequity, right? And I remember just like the instinct coming into play. I remember, you know, one powerful anecdote was this little girl, she's 2 years old, and she'd fallen off the balcony of a high-rise flat in Glasgow, I think the 12th floor, and she died. She'd hit the ground and died, and it was big news, and the story didn't sit well with me at all. I just didn't feel the story was right, and I went to Mass, the chapel, next to the high-rise estate where she'd grown up, and there was only about a dozen people in the Mass, and the priest had said, I can't remember the mum's name, but he said that, you know, he's got a message from her to the congregation and that she's sorry. And she's sorry that she threw the girl out of the window. And, my jaw drops and I realised that she killed the kid. But what drew me to go and try and find something in the story, it just didn't, because the story didn't add up, right? Just didn't add up. And then she got sectioned under the Mental Health Act as we went to press. And there's, hundreds of examples like that throughout my career.
Just something like that. Why wouldn't the priest or the community come forward and tell the police?
They'd already told the police. The police just hadn't told anyone else.
Ah, I see. Right. And you uncovered it. Right. Okay.
Yeah. You're talking the difference of a day, because the police did... You know, the police were going to go through the process of releasing the information, right? But you just didn't expect the priest to tell the community first. So the priest isn't subject to contempt of court. But the thing is, I suppose, and this was actually, a priest is subject to contempt of court. And this is, I guess, the lesson in this from a journalistic sense, is small margins. Small margins make you a genius. So the fact that I've got that story an hour before, 20 minutes before anyone else, makes me a genius, right? And so I started to realize that. And I made a joke, you know, that about your running is that, you know, like you, I'm a fast runner, you know. It's like I started to realize that being first on the scene and being quick to the story was the key to everything. And I became really good at that. And never stopping, never, you know, having that work ethic.
Do you think that work ethic has served you well throughout your career? And that tenacious ability to just sort of keep pushing yourself?
I think so. I think that, you know, even like I would do night shifts like all young journalists. So night shift would be, you'd start your shift at 8 o'clock and then finish at 2 a.m. It's called the graveyard shift for a reason, because you always end up covering murders. In true Taggart style in Glasgow, you end up covering murders, you know, murder, Laguna murder. And it makes me laugh, because back in the day, of course, they didn't really have Google, and before the advent of social media, obviously, and the newsroom was Google. So you'd be working night shift and you'd be on the desk, and then the phone would go, and it'd be all these people in the pub, and there'd just be noise and shouting and drinking. And then you just hear suddenly, "Shh, I've got the record on the phone." And then you'd be like, "Record, newsroom." And they would say, "Who scored the winning goal in the Scottish Cup final in 1936, right? And you'd be like, "Ah." And so you'd be, and you know for a fact, right, there's 30 people in the pub and they're all about to kill each other if you don't give the answer, because they're all, but they just think that, their relationship with a newspaper was that, the newspaper was the oracle, but it was always just calling the. But I remember just an example of this work ethic is getting a call at like midnight, and most journalists at that time would just be like, "I'm on my way out, mate. I'm going home. I'm done. My shift's done. I'm going to try and get a last drink, and then I'm going to go to bed." And there'd been an incident, a murder at a nightclub in Paisley, ironically, which is not far from the Daily Record's office in Glasgow. And so I went to the nightclub in the pouring rain. And I just thought, I'm going to find a story here. And I interviewed loads of people. And, you know, this one guy, I spent ages interviewing him, and I had all my notes and everything. And then a few days later, I was back on days, and the Strathclyde police, the local police force from Glasgow, turned up at the Daily Record offices, and they used to come and meet me quite a lot. And they took me into a little side office and said, "Is this you?" Knowing it was me, is a photograph of me interviewing this guy in the rain outside the nightclub. And it took me about a second to basically work out that I'd interviewed the killer. I was like, "That's the killer, isn't it?" Because straight away, you know. And they're like, "We can't possibly comment. I said, "It's the killer." I said, "And do you want my notes? I'll give you my notes, but I want this. And so he ends up, the poor said, but, you know, but I've grown up with brilliant journalists, but there's a small amount of us that would go out at midnight in the rain, you know.
So that's your work ethic. What about your sense of self-belief and ability to deliver? What do you think has been the greatest influence on that?
I think sport gave me a lot of belief. I think that You know, I think in another world, if I hadn't been good at football as a kid, I mean, every time a kid gets murdered in a housing estate in Scotland, they're called a talented footballer, you know. and they never are, you know, they never are. But I was lucky in the sense that I was, and that almost insulated me, because I was quite a smart kid, and I could easily have slipped through the net and just been this little kind of smart aleck in the corner, you know. But because I was good at football, I was kind of left alone, and I was allowed to thrive in that environment, and that probably gave me confidence. The word in Glasgow is gal. And as I would never describe it, which means cocksure, means it kind of means borderline arrogant. And a lot of people probably would mistake me as arrogant, certainly in my past. I'm not so much now, but
there's probably a similarity there between the classic case of someone that is smart. You can either get by without being harassed or bullied, is if you're one funny or you're good at sport. And you sort of delivered on that.
Very, very true. I don't think I was that funny as a kid. I'm not sure I'm that funny as an adult. Do you know, I recently had a conversation with someone, and I almost had a kind of out of body experience, and I realized I'm actually getting too serious. You know, I'm just quite this earnest person. I think that, you know, 126 countries later, whatever, and all the horrors I've seen have just turned me into this kind of over earnest, rather melancholy. I mean, when I was kind of thinking about the interview, I definitely think that I am quite self reflecting. And maybe part of that comes from being an only child for 11 years of my life. Because I'm not an only child. I have a lovely sister and have a great relationship with her, but everyone calls me an only child. So anyway.
Just on that, is that whole point of self-reflection and being a journalist? I mean, you talked a bit about Burns, and I think Burns got one of the classic quotes is, "But oh, would some power the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us." You, obviously, as a journalist, you can insulate yourself from what other people think because you just pursue the truth. So to a certain extent, you have to remove yourself and not worry about what people think of you. You can't be too self-conscious, too sensitive to it. You have to be tough and hard, I would suspect.
I think you definitely have to be quite thick-skinned, because it's easy to create enemies as a campaigning or investigative journalist. You know, a lot of people are, you know, maybe touch on that a little bit later. You know, one of the things about Burns is that he's two things: he's muscular and he's maudlin. Maudlin a universal word? I mean, I think maudlin's quite a Scottish word.
It's quite common.
Maudlin means effectively, again, going back to this kind of slightly melancholy, a wee bit self-reflective, and but muscular, obviously, you know. It's like, you know, my favourite line, one of my favourite films is Chariots of Fire, and Eric Liddell is a massive hero of mine, as he is to many Scots, I'm sure, certainly to you, Mark.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's a line in the film written by Colin Welland, a Welshman actually, but beautifully written screenplay, and Welland says, or he wrote that, you know, they were having a conversation with Liddell, and they were trying to get him to convert from rugby to becoming an Olympic athlete. And he said, "Eric, this is a time for a muscular Christian."
Yeah, and, I remember that. Yeah,
and it's such a powerful line, because you realise that to connect with people, to try and be successful at what you do, there's got to be a bit of aggression there. There's got to be a bit of arrogance. There's got to be a bit of muscle. And I think that's one of the reasons why Burns appeals to me and you know, a lot of other Scotch writers, is because he's muscular and maudlin. He's a drunk, he's a Flanderer, he's a ploughman, he's a socialist, he's a revolutionary, he's 100 different things, right? But we can shape him into what we aspire to be. But I think that as a journalist, you've got to be thick-skinned, you've got to be a wee bit muscular, and I would argue you've got to be a bit self-reflective as well. Because you've got this quite a solemn responsibility, right?
Were there any teachers at school that influenced you greatly, or your sense of purpose?
I was in Africa on assignment. I think I was in Liberia, and I was working as a Sunday Times Africa correspondent. And I heard a BBC World Service radio documentary on teachers, and it was all these quite famous people talking about teachers and the positive influence teachers had had in their lives, and how this one guy he basically said he'd never reached out to his teacher and said, and the teacher had died, and he basically shaped his entire career as a surgeon. I just thought, oh my God, I had this amazing teacher called David Jack. He was my religious studies teacher in secondary school, and he just gave me the most incredible confidence in my ability to think a little bit more intellectually, right? But I remember we were studying Hinduism because he's a religious studies teacher, and I remember him asking the class a question about Shiva. Now, Shiva has a third eye, and he said, "Does anyone know why Shiva has a third eye?" And everyone gave these answers, right? And the answers were, I mean, I have to be honest, I mean, I can't, I can't remember the specific of the answers, but they were fairly, I guess they were fairly prosaic. And I came up with this idea, and I said, perhaps Shiva has a third eye in the center of his forehead so that he can see the world from a different perspective. And it was this kind of silence in the classroom, and no one else knew what the hell I was talking about. And at the end of the class, he pulled me aside and he said, it's a really good answer. Not a lot of kids your age think like that. And I was like, okay. And then I think from that moment on, I took more of an interest in his class, and he was very engaged in my education and was a huge influence on me. And of course, later I lived in India, although my wife is Sikh, but I lived in India and found out that my answer was wrong because Shiva's got a third eye to turn gaze towards the ocean and destroy, I don't know. It was Oppenheimer that said, I am Shiva, the destroyer, yeah, when he invented when he split the atom or invented whatever they invented the nuclear bomb. But what was it? Which one was it? Anyway, hydrogen bomb. So there we go. But sorry, to finish the anecdote, as a consequence of the radio documentary that I'd heard when I was on assignment, is I contacted Mr. Jack David, as we are now, we're Facebook friends. I said, you know, I wrote him this letter. And it was in the field and I'd had a few beers and bad day in a refugee camp, and it was probably quite flowery, but it was like, you've had this and he knew I was, of course. I mean, I don't mean to sound arrogant, but I'm reasonably well known as a journalist, and he just wrote back to me the next day and said he was almost like reduced to tears by the fact that I'd take the time to, and it made me realise that we don't thank our teachers enough, you know.
It's a really good point. Yeah, it is something that a profession lacking in recognition from both the public and the parents, and also probably many students.
But he did nail me, because he made me basically go back to my school and give a talk. So that was the price of me contacting him. I had to go back to
my old school. That's wonderful. You talked about your journalistic career, the beginnings, and can you take us through the adventurous career that's spanned war correspondence to investigative journalism and all the way through to content creation. And across that, storytelling seems to be the red thread that runs through everything you do. Storytelling with a purpose. Can you just talk a bit more about that journey and what inspired you to focus on that?
I know you mentioned
Tintin and Tap being that initial inspiration, but to jump from being plenty of people, I'm sure. I interviewed Gordon Young, founder
of The Drum.
And he started out, obviously, in Glasgow as well, creating his own school fanzine magazine and then launching the Glaswegian, and then obviously went into media. You went beyond Glasgow. You went from being a journalist for the Daily Record, as you say, a very successful and respected tabloid journal in Scotland and to a certain extent in the UK, but went from there into broadsheet journalism and international journalism. So what was it that spurred you on and led you to take that different path out of Scotland?
I think that, you know, you mentioned the theme of serendipity. I mean, one of the serendipities in my life was meeting my wife, and I'd been working in a lot of foreign assignments at that point, and I met her during the tsunami in Sri Lanka, 2004. She was there for the BBC, and I think that was quite a hard thing to cover. You know, the tsunami in 2004, 2005 remains unprecedented, and, you know, but this tsunami obviously was 230,000 people died. I mean, I think we were there for 3-4 weeks, almost a month, and I met Navdeep in a school where 400 children had died. And I remember being in the school, and there's a photograph of me taken in the school by a friend at the UN, and I've got my head in my hands, and I'm crying, and I'm really upset. You know, I think that the school was coming, the story was coming to, I hate to say it, but the story was coming to an end. We'd all been, you know, from, you know, walking across beaches, you know, full of dead bodies. And, you know, everyone that's a journalist that were there in the early stages had found a piece of a child or a piece of, you know, someone stuck in a tree. Or I know journalists that covered the Lockerbie disaster and find journalists, but they struggled. They were finding people in trees because they were first on the scene.
Yes, I know, it was horrific as well.
And obviously the tsunami was a very extreme version of that. And I met Navdeep. And one of the things that I saw in the school was the school register. And I realized the reason that we were all at the school because the local authority had asked all the pupils to come to the school to register their names. And I kind of quickly realised that we'd done that to work out who was dead and who was alive. And the school register was drying. It must have been under a puddle for weeks on end, just still soaking wet. And it was drying in the stairs. I mentioned it to Narty. But you could see the kids lining up and they were looking at each other and they were like opening their mouth and saying, have you seen such and such? Have you seen such and such? They were talking. They were trying to work out which of their friends had died. I was so impacted by that because I just thought that's just the worst thing imaginable. The children, it's an unfathomable thing, right, in terms of all of our history as a tsunami, even to this day. But for the children to try and comprehend that, and they're trying to comprehend it, not in the context of it impacting 14 countries and 250 million people dying, but just in terms of has their best friend made it.
It's always that classic thing when you tell a story like 229,000 people dying, it sounds horrific. When you tell the story of an individual or a group of small individuals in a very personal context, it always has more power. And obviously, and certainly for the victims of that, it must have been a horrific scene to encounter. And actually, so to give it that context of kids probably looking distraught and bereft, knowing that their friends are gone, it must have been very hard to digest and to watch and to report on.
But I think the one thing this gave me an appetite for was this kind of knowledge that the children effectively in this story, in this little window that I had at the time, were completely helpless to the circumstances, to everything around them. And it made me feel a bit helpless, but then also a bit like, well, I have to do them justice. You know, I remember what I wrote about as well. The first line of that, the piece that I wrote in that day was a simple wooden desk, a pencil and the registration form. This is how they count the dead in a school playground in southern Sri Lanka. And it was simple. And I realised that actually, if I'm going to hit people with how it is, you have to make it simple because it's child's play, right? It's like kids working out who's dead. But anyway, the serendipity aspect of it was I met Navdeep, and then we had it. She was BBC's Asia correspondent, and we had a drink and we got married 6 months later. So, you know, I moved to Delhi and lived with her in India and became the Asia correspondent for The Observer and The Guardian.
Well, let's go back. So what led you, Dan, to go from being a tabloid journalist into international broadsheets, particularly covering wars, social injustice and conflicts around the world?
I think when I was living in India working for The Observer and The Guardian, I found myself waking up to globalization because it was a first foreign posting for me in the sense that I was surrounded by poverty every day of my life, right? And I started to kind of become obsessed with the A to B of life. I was thinking, okay, so how did that jumper get from A to B? How did, you know, where's this made? What's that made? And I just became, going back to this, you know, a phrase that you used earlier, this kind of curiosity, but the curiosity in me was burning. And it was all to do with, you know, at this point in 2004, 2005, Starbucks was becoming a thing. There was, you know, companies where there was much more globalization. The high street was starting to disappear. Big companies and corporations were starting to really put an imprint on the world in terms of fast fashion was starting and, you know, lots of different things.
It was when Naomi Klein published her book, No Logo, which was sort of the siren call to a generation to sort of wake up call to the potential downside of globalization.
You put it much better than me. But I mean, I would say that if I was to be really honest, I think that my patch at this time, as journalistic patch, was Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, India, Afghanistan, Burma, and Bangladesh. And when I was there, every one of these countries was at war, including India, because they had insurgencies in the north and all sorts of stuff coming on. And so I found myself just going around in circles. You know, I got arrested in Burma and trying to cover death camps and, you know, covered a civil war in Nepal, covered the war in Afghanistan, natural disasters. It was like stock and trade, you know, roving foreign correspondent. But every time I finished an assignment, I would go home to Delhi, where I was surrounded by street children, poverty everywhere, like literally outside the compound where I lived in Delhi, there was 6-year-olds sleeping in this gutter. And so for me, it was like I started to kind of become really interested in the journeys of these children. And that drew me into child labour investigations, which for many years I was very well known for. I mean, I've exposed the Gap Inc. many times, from, you know, like 3 times, I think, for major global investigations. But I found children working in the supply chain of Gap Kids, which became a major international story on Good Morning America. And, you know, we ran all over the world. And I started to work with an NGO called the Global March Against Child Labour. And I brought them huge international attention because obviously my stories were getting covered all over the world. And they were given the Nobel Peace Prize. The founder was given the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago. And so I worked with them intensively on child labour, breaking into sweatshops and uncovering this, I guess, this my insatiable appetite for the A to B of life, right? Where does this jacket come from? Where are these shoes made? Where's the leather from these shoes made? And India was like the best place in the world to find these things, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan. I remember one sweatshop that we found in Delhi making clothes for a Western company. And I can't name the company because it ended up in Slate Legal. We never published it. An American company, very large one. And they were, the children were on the fifth floor with a cantonment building in Delhi of a slum. And they were working as bonded slaves. The kids were aged between 10 and 12. And they were working 16, 17-hour days. And five floors below the kids, because basically the sweatshop owners had locked the door and basically given them the sari embroidery. So they were having to embroider for 16, 17 hours a day. And they were sliding food under the door, and water was being given to them. You know, they had a big kind of urn water under the corner. So they were prisoners, basically. And sometimes the sweatshops, to keep on top of them, you know, they kind of hit them and they use sticks called lattes and they beat them with them. But in this case, they were being left to their own devices. And if they didn't deliver the next morning a certain prerequisite number of jerseys or garments, then they were beaten. So it was almost like they were hostages. But the worst thing about the story was five floors below the sweatshop was a school. And this was the thing. This was the thing that really broke my heart. So every day they were working 16, 17-hour days, and for half of that day, listening to school children play and lessons and the cycle of life, the school bell, you know, the clanging bell they have in India. Yeah. And that was quite sobering. And I think that moment for me almost put me onto this campaign that I was going to tell the world about child labour, and I wasn't going to stop. You know, it was the ultimate ignominy for me because they weren't only bonded slaves, but they were listening to children have the life that children should have, which is a life of play and education. A hard story.
I think anyone that goes to your Wikipedia page will get a sense of the awards that you've won for your endeavours, and fairly what I think could be fairly described as a fearless mission to uncover these stories. I know that Churchill is often referenced as saying this quote. Well, I actually don't think it was him. I think it was came an ad from Budweiser, funnily enough, which is success is not final, failure is not fatal. It's the capability to continue that matters. But in terms of your story, your failure in any one of these instances could well have been fatal. You're taking on large corporations, probably with brutal security details in countries where journalists may not be respected to the degree they are in America and in the West. And your fearlessness is probably taking into some very sort of risky places. I mean, obviously seeing those children suffering like that must have spurred you on. But there's still something else inside you that must give you that sort of that fearlessness to go further than other people have to uncover these human rights injustices.
I think I was a little bit annoyed when I became a foreign correspondent because I realised that there was a clubby nature to it, right? There's a journey that you go on in the rarefied air to join the rarefied air of the foreign correspondent in the British newspapers like the Times or even the Guardian. The Guardian is just as guilty. Where you go from private school to Oxford or Cambridge to an internship on the desk at the Times, and then, you know, then by definition, you know, a job on the Diary, or and then you become a foreign correspondent, and it's a well-trodden path, right? I mean, you know, I know so many of my peers and colleagues have gone that way.
Same in diplomatic circles with Foreign Office. Same, there's a parallel.
I've been interested to know if advertising is the same, but it is
historically, apart from the creative department, it's often been a working class area of success. So yeah,
that's worthy of more reflection. But I certainly think that I wanted to get my hands dirty, and I realised straight early on that I wasn't going to sit and play tennis and rest on my laurels and, you know, write a book. I was going to go out there and I was on a mission, I guess. And I remember breaking into a sweatshop with my photographer, Adrian Fisk. And I had a translator with me who was a former sweatshop owner. And we got attacked by the the guards carrying these big wooden sticks, and they fractured the translator's skull and then came after me, and they smashed Adrian's cameras. And I remember this Keystone Cops scenario being chased through the slum in Delhi. It's 100 degrees and they're chasing me through the slum, and Adrian's going in another direction, and there's three of them on me. And then, you know, I say, Mark, I'm a decent runner, not like you, but I can run. And eventually there's only two of them on me, and I kind of turned over my shoulder and I was still running, and I thought, this is ridiculous. They're just little guys. And I turned around and started chasing them. And my driver, Sukram, was on the other side of this river. And I remember just thinking, why am I chasing these guys? And I turned again and then got to him, and Adrian had found his way around. And, you know, the anecdotes around sweatshop investigations are, you know, all over the world. I could probably spend an hour just talking about them. But I mean, the German press have been in the media quite a lot in the last few weeks because of this fake journalism scandal involving the Spiegel journalist. But as a freelancer, I worked for Stern magazine, and Stern have the most extraordinary check and measure system. I investigated a company called Otto, which are a multi-billion pound German industrial corporation, and they owned a fashion chain called Heine, big catalogue company in Germany, super successful. We should maybe legal this, but I think it's pretty safe. And basically, I uncovered child labor in Otto's supply chain. And the CEO of Otto was about to retire. And this was a scandal he could not cope with. So he said, shut it down. And so they put pressure onto Stern, and they started investigating me. They were investigating Stern. They were trying to do anything to shut it down. And Stern said that I had to meet lawyers from Otto in Delhi to show the evidence and to explain the story, which is not the British way. The British way is that we're going to give you 24 hours and we're going to call your press office and we're going to say, we found children in your supply chain, mate. Here's the evidence. Here's the pictures. If you don't reply in 24 hours, there's a no comment, which isn't really fair. I mean, you should give them longer. In fact, I was one of the journalists to encourage this kind of longer period. But the period with Stern and this company Otto became 6 weeks, allowing them 6 weeks to respond. So Otto sent over some lawyers from their corporate headquarters in Germany and some dentists from Germany. And so the next question is, why have they sent dentists to meet an investigative journalist? And I met them in the Imperial Hotel in Delhi. And I was in a baseball cap and my trainers, and possibly a little bit hungover, looking at these German dentists produce x-rays of the children's mouths. And they basically said to me that the children I'd found making their clothes in sweatshop were not children. They were young adults. And that the photographs, the x-rays of the mouths of these young adults prove that they had molars and erupting molars, and they'd reached puberty. And they were saying this in broken English. And so you can imagine what happened next was, you know, I stood up and I started shouting, and the thing is now the more tranquil me would be very much like, you're making a mistake here, right? Think about this. But then it was just outrage and total war. And it took me another month, I think, but I got the birth certificates to the kids, and they were 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. And we ran the dentist anecdote in full. So it's a multi-billion pound company.
So that CEO must have retired in somewhat of a cloud of disgrace.
He had another year. And then he quit. Your question's in the German Parliament, of course, as well. But let's just basically drill this down into a simple fact: a multi-billion-pound company photographed the mouths of children
to justify their
supply chain.
Yeah,
and it says Stern. I mean, if you can read German, you know the English translation of it, but it's an incredible story. But the thing is, I mean, that, you know, I give a talk at Cambridge, which is when corporations attack, and that's entirely based on my experiences of companies coming after me personally, or, you know, my Wikipedia page you mentioned earlier has been assaulted by so many different, edited by so many different PR companies and lobbyists, and, you know, what can you do?
Well, I'm going to come on and talk about the affliction of fake news at the moment. But I'd just like to come back to investigative journalism a bit more. I mean, your response to that obviously was rage and unbridled anger. But investigative journalism must have with it, apart from obviously your fearlessness, your unrelenting desire to dig deeper to find that story, to do that must combine an interesting combination of what I perceive to be analytical thinking and creativity. Because stories just don't turn up on your desk, particularly when you're a foreign correspondent in the field, it must take digging. It must take a bit of an analysis and problem solving and creativity in terms of how to unlock answers from people or relationships. Can you talk to me a bit about that interesting sort of combination? And if it's not that, what is it that allows you to get to the story or get to the heart of the story like you did there?
So I think that one of the biggest challenges of being an investigative journalist, particularly around human rights, is compassion fatigue. And I think a lot of people these days talk about living in the attention economy, right? And I think that this is a big problem for anyone that wants to communicate human rights issues to a global audience. And this is maybe one of the reasons why I was able to set up a creative agency, a content agency, because I realized that from a very early stage that it sounds, you know, if you listen to the anecdotes about investigating tobacco companies and, you know, global supply chains or covered wars or disasters, these are all very much stock and trade. Maybe not the big global investigations, but the stock and trade job of a foreign correspondent, right? From a very early stage, I was very interested in finding new ways to tell stories. And it was one of the first, you know, major foreign correspondents in the UK to tackle multimedia in a really robust way. I saw the very early potential of that. And to this day, newspapers still make terrible films, right? Apart from The Guardian makes some, but The Times Group's, you know, film output is appalling. It's never improved. I've never understood this because it's a huge gap in the market. But so I had this combination of two things, I think, lateral thinking and a desire to tell it in a way that would impact people. And so a good example of this was during the World Cup in South Africa. I was posted to Africa as a Sunday Times Africa correspondent. And I decided to focus on the World Cup. Nobody was talking about HIV. And so I watched the first couple of games of the World Cup in an HIV hospice in Cape Town, where we photographed the patients who were literally dying to palliative care. I mean, they were there, they were literally in the last legs. It was just the last few weeks of their lives. And we interviewed them and spoke to them about their lives as they watched the final game, the beginning of the World Cup, which they wouldn't see the end of the tournament. And I thought this was such a startling juxtaposition between these athletes at the peak of their powers and the dying patients. And it just summed up this real powerful narrative. And we eventually did a radio piece on it. And I kind of started at that point in Africa to think that if I'm going to connect with an audience and not make them fatigued by the poverty, what they call, people call it poverty porn, it's a terrible saying, but I don't want to use that saying, but for them to have compassion fatigue, for them not to care, it's like, you know, in any famine, and I've covered famines in Somalia and Sudan and Mozambique, in any famine, right, there is a point where, even with the tsunami, there's a point where the viewer or the reader just gets fed up. They're just, they're too full up, right? They don't want to eat anymore. And so I guess what this spurred in me was almost like a more confrontational form of journalism, but something that also had really powerful content. So I decided to write a magazine piece about child rape in South Africa. The starting point of that conversation is, right, to your news editor, to the magazine editor of the Sunday Times, is you're going to write about child rape. I mean, who writes about child rape, right? Nobody. It's like taboo. And I worked with Mariella Fuhrer, a brilliant Swiss photographer based in Nairobi. And the story eventually won awards and stuff. But the most important part of the story was that I got access to a clinic where children had been raped and had been taken in for assessment. And I asked the nurse, the chief nurse, the sister, if we could look through the photographs and the drawings that the children made when they were admitted to the ward. And it was like therapy. So they would draw pictures of what happened to them. And so we looked through hundreds of these pictures, and they're devastating. And Mariella had very cleverly taken photographs of the children holding the pens, and they were holding it with their fists. He'd send you the pictures, are extraordinary. You know, what does a child that's been sexually abused hold a pen like? Well, they grip it with one hand and a fist, and they draw in these dark, heavy lines. I mean, you can literally see the indentations in the paper, so depth of the trauma. And I convinced the Sunday Times Magazine to run these images of the children's drawings, and they're heavy. And, you know, at the end of the day, on a Sunday morning, do people want to read that? Do they want to read about child rape? Do they want to read about what's happened? But it was such an urgent story. I mean, one in four children in these townships are being sexually abused in the age of 3 or 4. So I felt that the urgency of the story needed me to look at it in a creative way to communicate with people. The same thing with piracy. You know, I'd covered piracy in Somalia and everyone was obsessed with piracy, but nobody was really understanding it. So I broke the piracy story down into a supply chain. I realized it had become a business. And so I did a magazine piece interviewing a hostage negotiator who was making hundreds of thousands of pounds a year from negotiating with pirates. I interviewed a pirate. I interviewed the skipper of a ship. I interviewed the bagman that took the money off the tarmac in Mogadishu. And I turned it into a chapter narrative, which really worked brilliantly because people suddenly got this idea coming alive. I mean, the example that I made recently, I'm just finished reading A History of Bees, which is fairly rubbish, but it's the same principle. It's like it's a narrative that focuses on individuals to give you the bigger picture. And so that kind of lateral thinking for me is the key to successful human rights journalism. You know, like everyone was investigating FIFA, but I decided to investigate the trafficking of children from Africa to France under the pretense of them having football trials for major clubs. And that the lessons that I learned from Asia and India and Pakistan and places where the world's a supply chain, right? And that's always informed my journalism. The point of departure is seeing everything as a supply chain.
Just to get a sense on the timeline. When you were doing war correspondence, that was before you doing working in foreign correspondence on supply, uncovering supply chain.
No, it's all simultaneous. It's all like it's not like, you know, the thing is that one thing that any foreign correspondent, investigative journalist would say, if you could give them, what would be your wish for Christmas, right? What can you give me? And it would be time. Just give me time. Give me time. Give me a year on this one story and I'll come back. Right. And historically, all of the best journalism, the Pulitzer Prize winning journalism, the award winning journalism, my own award winning journalism has been enabled by time and patience. But unfortunately, the day to day is not. So I would go from sweatshop to the war in Afghanistan or the war in Sri Lanka, or, you know, the thing that bought me time was awards and being successful. And then people would say, we'll give Dan a month on this. And that's the difference. And also as well, I think that I became much more of a long form feature writer. Like I went to cover the drug wars in Mexico for Esquire. I you know, the Sunday Times magazine would send me to the Australian outback to investigate refugees. And so I pretty much could just effectively just put a dot on a map and say, right, I'm going to go here. And I still can do that. And that's just, I guess, success brings you that in some respects.
Couple quick questions just as you're talking through that. One, the obvious question, what place have you been where you felt most at risk? And the second, what story didn't you break that you could have broken or could have exposed given more time?
Question, I have an answer for that. So I think that one of the things that I get asked about a lot is post-traumatic stress. And obviously, I've covered a lot of horrendous situations and conflicts and everything. And I think that I remember a few years ago being sent to Yemen to investigate the shoe bomber who tried to...
Richard Reid.
Yeah, and Richard Reid's got a better memory than me.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, being told by the hotel manager, you know, that I was going to get kidnapped, and not feeling very comfortable about that. And he personally took me to the airport. And the same in Somalia. I mean, Somalia, I covered the war, the Al-Shabaab frontline. I went to Somalia, to Mogadishu. And I've been to Somalia a number of times. I've been here to cover the famine anyway. But in Mogadishu, I was covering the war between Al-Shabaab and the African Union. And we embedded with them. And I was with a photographer called John Cantley, a wonderful guy. And we started to work together a bit more. And our convoy was targeted by a suicide bomb. And the suicide bomb went off early. And it went out right outside the police station, or just in the edge of a police station, killed half a dozen people, missed us. And we were taken to the stadium. I think it was a scene in Black Hawk Down where they go to the stadium when they escape, basically. It's the same stadium, but that they didn't film in Mogadishu, obviously. And we kind of we contoured there, and we kind of came around in a loop, and we could see the plume of smoke that had come up, and we heard obviously the explosion. And John Cantley, who was with me at the time, he was a very gung-ho character, John. And, you know, we were coming back through the market, central market in Mogadishu, and he wanted to jump out and start shooting photographs. And, you know, the literally Al-Shabaab were, you know, we were a target, right? We were a moving target, and the African Union guys were quite upset. But John, it's really sad, but John eventually, he was supposed to come to Zimbabwe with me to cover an investigation, and he went to Syria instead, and he was kidnapped by ISIS, and he's still there. John's been in captivity for 5 years. But the thing that probably a turning point for me coming out of that backdrop was when I flew out of Mogadishu. I landed in Nairobi and my phone was going crazy and I had all these text messages and, you know, people emailing me, and my colleague at the Sunday Times, Marie Colvin, had been murdered in Syria. She'd been killed by Assad's regime, who targeted her in a shell. And so you do start to realize, you know, I was talking recently, is that, you know, when people you like and people you respect are getting kidnapped and killed, and you realize that this isn't normal. And I think Africa is that, you know, one thing that I often say is that Africa's not for wimps, it's not for the faint-hearted. You know, I think I've reported from like 45 or 46 African countries of 55. You know, during my 5 or 6 years there, I was working for the Sunday Times as Africa correspondent, but also as an investigative journalist and documentary maker for BBC Panorama. And so I didn't have a break from it. I was just constantly on the road, and I was investigating blood diamonds, I was investigating human trafficking, piracy, famine, conflict, war. There wasn't really any respite.
So I suppose, given that you're married by this time to Navdeep, and you've got children, the pressure to probably do the right thing by your family versus doing the right thing by uncovering the next big story brought you to a point of reflection in terms of where you're the next chapter of your journey.
I'm kind of, you know, I'm prone to kind of quotes, and you know, there's a quote from Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which is, you know, everyone has three lives, a public life, a private life, and a secret life. Mm-hmm. And that's how I approach storytelling, right? Because I thought as a correspondent, I had to traverse all three of these things, right? But then something beyond that, my job was to often reveal an unpalatable truth. And you know, my constant companion at this time was Robin Hammond. He's a National Geographic photographer, and like me, very campaigning journalist. And I spent more time with Robin than I probably did with Navdeep, my wife at the time. And we were constantly on the road. But there was an unpalatable truth at the heart of my life, is that I was emotionally starting to fall apart, and I was struggling and emotionally. And so there's this disconnect between my life, right? Huge disconnect between me being in the Sudan, breaking into a prison and uncovering child soldiers in chains, or covering the famine in Somalia, or, you know, wherever I am, and then going home to my family in Cape Town. Mm. And my kids are playing in the pool, or we're having Sunday lunch in a vineyard, or I'm in the sea surfing. And it's a terrible disconnect. It's like suddenly you're going from extreme to not only normal, but I would say idyllic. Anyone who's been to Cape Town or lives in Cape Town, mm-hmm, must understand that. That was probably my mistake, because the Sunday Times wanted me to be in Nairobi, but I insisted in Cape Town, and maybe there would have been less of a disconnect, because Nairobi's pretty crazy all the time, so it wouldn't have been that much of a juxtaposition, contrast. Came to a head for me. I was investigating just a typical idea that I had, is that I decided to investigate money. So I got a coin, a pound coin in the UK. I got it chemically assessed or whatever. They broke it down and told me what was in it. And because I went to prove that the Royal Mint was unethical, that money was unethical. So I went to a mine, a nickel mine in Madagascar. And then I went to a copper mine in Chile. And then I was trying to prove the supply chain of money is corrupted, and it's like it's destroying the environment, and it's not paying people properly, which I did eventually prove. And the Royal Mint had to admit they didn't know where the metal came from. But anyway, I was in Bolivia in a side assignment from there, and we'd driven across the desert from Bolivia to Chile. And it's not a benign journey, right? It's a horrible 14-hour jarring journey, right? But somehow in the middle of it, we got lost in the desert. And, you know, I'd been in much worse situations and normally quite philosophical, but I just burst into tears. I just had it. I think it had come at the end of a very, very intense period of reporting, and I was sitting in, you know, just in tears. And, you know, Robin's looking at me, my photographer, like, what's wrong with that? Do you know what I mean? It's like, but I think that if I realized that, probably going back 2006, 2007 was when I first started to show signs of post-traumatic stress. You know, like there's a wonderful scene in a film called The Hurt Locker, where and Catherine Bigelow does an incredible job with that. But when he goes to the supermarket aisle and he starts just losing his shit, looking at the cereal. And actually, a friend of mine really this very similar story of experiencing that And I can understand that. I can relate to that, right? It's like the things that get you, it creeps up on you. It hits you when you least expect it, you know? I think the one thing that just before that incident, me and Robin had been in the Congo covering the war in the Congo. And we'd interviewed a woman who'd been raped by a militia, and the woman had recognised her rapist and he'd cut out her eyes.
Oh.
And then we went to Bosnia after that.
And she lived.
Yeah, she lived, yeah. The photographs of her.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
But I remember interviewing her, and I remember, the thing is, I'm kind of weird as a correspondent or interviewee, because I remember holding her hand during the interview, which seems totally inappropriate. But in Africa and Asia, even, really less so in Asia, but in Africa, that's quite normal. If someone's upset, you hold their hand. And I've never really believed...
Sorry, go ahead.
I've never really believed in this distance, you know, between... It's a very English thing, I think. I think this goes back to being working class Scot, is that it's a very English thing to kind of sit on a pedestal and say, you know, what is that awful book? It's not awful book, sorry, the title of a book. So during the war in Bosnia, a correspondent had gone in, I think the correspondent worked for a TV network, had gone into a gymnasium in Bosnia. A correspondent had gone into a gymnasium in Croatia, in Split, where refugees were staying, and he basically said, has anyone here been raped and can speak English? And it later became a title for a book. And I think that there's a real disconnect between the correspondent, particularly the private educated correspondent, and the interviewee, because there somehow seems to be an entitlement there. And I've never felt like an entitled correspondent. I've always empathised in the deepest way with the people I'm interviewing, and I haven't felt their pain, because look, I've not been raped, I've not lived in a refugee camp, I've not been through anything that they've dealt with, but in some level I felt that I have cared.
Mm. How do you control what must be quite raw anger in the face of such gross injustice that you've experienced and seen firsthand in the world? Live with it. I mean, the organisations that you work for presumably don't give you counselling, therapy sessions to deal with this.
I think there's definitely been what do they say about foreign correspondents? They're dead, drunk or divorced.
Thankfully, you're none of those, Dan.
But the thing is, like, it could easily have gone in any of those directions. And I think that obviously having Navdeep in my life, and she herself was an accomplished foreign correspondent, understands the challenges of the job. But I think also I did start to go to therapy to try and reconcile a lot of things that were going on in my head over the years. And I think confronting it certainly helps. But I suppose that's the negative about being a Scot, Mark. You'll understand that, is that there's not a lot of Scots in therapy. it's like they're very stoical.
I mean, it's a completely Scotch man of a certain age, brought up to take it on the chin and just get on with life and don't complain. That's taking that sort of slightly stoic attitude to life, probably is ingrained in us.
And I think by definition that attitude is harmful. So I think, you know, I think one of the first things that I discussed was how I felt, and the therapist, when my first therapist said that I was in mourning. I was in quite a kind of perpetual state of mourning, which is, you know, and I think that if I was to say, well, you know, I'm lucky because I have this, you know, successful life, and, you know, what have I got to be upset about? And that was how I'd almost reconciled it by saying that, what have I got to be upset about? Mm-hmm.
I'm going to, because I'm conscious of your time and it's late there, I'm just going to get onto the last few questions. So, you know, I've known you since 2015, and you've always struck me as someone that holds truth very dear. And this interview has obviously shown your passion for the truth. We're living in a world where trust and faith in journalism and the news is being eroded to a poisonous degree. And we're living with this term that I deplore, fake news, and essentially is just a deluge of disinformation. How do you think we're going to overcome this?
I think what we're having with class relotius is, you know, it's one of the worst cases I've heard, but I mean, Stephen Glass, I mean, you know, there's been other cases over the years. It seems to me that he's clearly at war with... He's not just at war with the truth, but he's almost at war with the journalistic establishment. There's something in him that's very resentful of the organisations he works for. And I think obviously it's an extreme case, but there's, you know, journalism is being undermined, you know, on a daily basis. I think the Guardian's model is excellent. I mean, I've worked for the Guardian. And I think that the model of journalism is outstanding, but they're still not paying journalists enough. But at least we're trying to find new sources of funding journalism. So the Guardian's foreign coverage these days is funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. It's funded by Hewlett Packard. It's funded by foundations, but corporations. And I think that's the road that we have to go down. We have to all be invested in journalism, and it has to be at the heart of our society. And I don't mean that in a conceited way. I mean, obviously, there are lots of important jobs, but, you know, you take journalism away and what's left? I mean, it used to kind of drive me crazy, right? I mean, I'm banned from quite a few countries. Like, you know, I'm banned from the Sudan. I'm banned from Egypt for my covering of the kidnapping of Christian girls. I was banned from Burma for a long time, and obviously I'm banned from Sri Lanka. I only found that out recently when I went there to make a film, and they arrested me at the airport and deported me. I got banned from covering the war there, and when I feel like, you know, like I'm being banned from countries, right? That seems to not just be a personal affront on me, but it just seems to be an assault on person, on freedom, on, you know, like I should have the right to go there and report, right? And when you start banning journalists or you start undermining belief in journalism, you're harming society, I would say. I don't know. I mean, it goes back to this idea about creativity, right? Is that, I mean, I'm a really believer in this argument that every emotion counts. So as an investigative journalist, part of you wants to just piss everyone off. You want to smash the windows of the corporation. You want to tackle big targets. You want to bring them down. You want people to stand up and think, this is not good. You want people to be angry. You want to solicit, and you want to almost like tease out something from them. If they're not responding to your story, you're failing, right? If you're not getting a response, if you're not getting through to the viewer, the listener, to the reader, then you've failed. And you have to find ways to do that in the attention economy that we live in.
Was that part of the reason that you set up your own content creation business, is to find new ways to deliver storytelling?
We set up Mirren because I probably would have ended up getting shot.
I'm sure, yeah, based on some of the stories you've got, yeah, I'm sure you probably would have.
And I think also as well, I think that we had to, as a family, come up with something that was going to make sure that I was around, and I would be lying if I was saying it was altruistic. It wasn't like suddenly, you know, we were going to change the world through content. But actually, I did realise quite early on, and I spoke to you in the early stages of it, that we would be good at creating content around social impact issues because of our incredible experience, right? Navdeep and me. So we'd be good at this, and we'd also understand big thinking, global issues. And also we'd bring this cultural knowledge and, you know, with respect to the advertising industry, or, you know, there's a lot of things that have been disrupted, but in the very early stages of Mirren, I was invited to give quite a lot of talks to advertising companies. And I felt at times like I was speaking to children, you know. I just didn't feel that they weren't really engaged in the world in the way that they should be, but also they didn't have any knowledge of a lot of the issues they were tackling. You know, they weren't able to draw on this backstory. It was actually all quite vacuous. I found that really disappointing, but I also found it an opportunity for us. I mean, I gave a talk at Google last year in San Francisco, and I remember, you know, there's a couple of hundred people, and it was there in the corporate office, and I remember asking how many nationalities are in the room, and there was like 30 nationalities or something, and I was really pleased by that because you could see that things are starting to change. Yeah. And even in the last 3 years, 4 years, you know this as well as anyone, is that there is more diversity, and people are thinking about storytelling in a different way. And I think the more people like me and Navdeep that get involved in storytelling for organizations or foundations, whatever, the better, because you've got to get people from all different backgrounds to form the whole, you know.
Okay, just building on the troubling times that we're living in, obviously there's optimism there as well. And given that you have witnessed injustice and the pain, the suffering to a very extreme degree, you were given the keys to the White House at Downing Street in a lighthearted way, but quite serious. What would you actually start changing?
So I'd stop Brexit. I mean, I would stop Brexit straight away, right in its tracks. I mean, I live in Europe. I live in Barcelona. You know, I have a Spanish identity card now, and I'm a Brexile. I mean, I've lived in India and Africa, and I lived in Thailand. So I've lived, you know, all over the world for the last 15 years of my life, whatever, and longer. And I have decided to not live in the UK. So because of Brexit, so I'm effectively a Brexile, because I don't really recognise what's happening to the UK in terms of political sentiment. And I talked earlier about Thatcherism, and but the conservative mismanagement of the country is a disgrace. So I think that austerity is something that concerns me. I mean, I did an In Conversation with the great war photographer Don McCullen last year. Yeah. So, I did an In Conversation with Sir Don McCullen. Yeah. At Soho House, and we had dinner after, and Don was talking to me about the shocking poverty in Britain that he documented and became famous for in his '60s. Yeah. And I remember just asking him about austerity, and he was appalled. He just could see it coming full circle again, you know. And so I think divide is something that really upsets me about the UK. And I think so. I certainly, if I was to do a number of things as Prime Minister, God forbid, because I'm a Scottish nationalist with a small s and a small n. But I do, my romantic Scots heart wants Scotland to be independent, but only independent from the Conservative Party or from Whitehall in that sense. You know, I would impose a corporation tax like Germany's of like 30% overnight, and I would backdate tax on technology companies that have evaded tax. I'd probably look at a one-off tax for the wealthy, the richest 10% in the country, and use that to repair existing structures of the NHS or plug austerity gaps and, you know, issues like food banks that Britain's facing.
It's interesting. I made me think I saw New York Times journalist Anand Giridharadas speak at a couple of events recently. He's recently written a book. If you haven't got it, you should get your hands on it. It's called Winners Take It All. And essentially, it is his damning indictment of how the great and the good, through the redistribution and reappropriation of the wealth, the 0.1 of the 1%, helping justify that reappropriation of their wealth by giving. But in giving, they're ignoring what would have gone to governments in taxes to cover education, to cover infrastructure, to cover social insurance and all the things that people need. And we're being sold by their stories of their giving, when reality is actually they are the cause of actually what the distress and the suffering and the social injustice is happening in countries around the world at the moment. It's a really, really interesting read.
Yeah, I'll buy it. Well, I think just briefly on that is that Paul Heaton, Beautiful South lead singer and songwriter and former House Martin, is kind of a bit of a weird hero of mine. I've met him, I like him a lot, and he's obviously earned so much money from songwriting. I think they've almost sold as many albums in the UK as the Beatles, and he's a real tax campaigner. He pays his taxes, and the band have to, and they're very, very transparent about that, because obviously for the same reasons you're just describing. I mean, I think from an education perspective, and I mentioned this to Navdeep, and she hated the idea because her argument is this was naive. But I think overnight, I would, if I was Prime Minister of the UK, is I would force Oxford and Cambridge to impose a moratorium on privately educated students entering the new college. And obviously, I lecture at Cambridge, and you can call me a hypocrite, but I think that something has to be done in a more radical way to ensure state school children get access to the top universities. And you know, Navdeep's argument against that stupid idea possibly was that, well, they just find another university to appropriate, so Durham would become the new Cambridge, or there's ways around it. But I think that there has to be some radical steps being moved. I think the thing that I'd become obsessed with if I was leader of a country would be breaking the class ceiling, not the glass ceiling, but the class ceiling, because this is something that I have felt hasn't held me back, but it's certainly something that I've had to circumvent, right?
I agree with that. I mean, obviously, you can apply that to class system, caste system, wealth system in America, and race. Every country has its relevant comparison. But going forward, I mean, as we with young children growing up in the 21st century, dealing with the huge risks that we face with climate change as we are likely to approach a 3-degree increase, leaving aside the risks of what's going to happen with an uncontrolled, unregulated AI arms race from an educational standpoint, if you read, just taking Yuval Noah Harari's, one of the points that he makes in his book, Rules of 21 Rules of 21st Century, kids will need to be learning the four C's, critical thinking, communication, collaboration, creativity. Your point about universities and changing it is great and would be a welcome radical shake-up of the education system. But everyone, regardless of class, regardless of race, regardless of creed, are going to be facing the same unified challenge. And it appears to me that there aren't any education authorities or systems around the world embracing this need and this the need for radical change. How are you, on an individual basis, helping your children embrace these skills, such as critical thinking, better communication skills, being more collaborative, embracing their creativity?
I think, interestingly...
A long rambling question, but...
No, it's a good question. I mean, I think that I've kind of decided that I'm going to return to some environmental and journalism investigations next year. I've already spoken to the Guardian about it, and I think that this is something that I really want to do for my children's sake, because I want them to, you know, they're old enough now to read you know lots of my stories and investigations, but I think to be something that present and maybe even consider taking them on the assignments. I mean, I've taken my son on film shoots before to try and connect them in a different way beyond school to what's happening in the world, you know. And I think we become institutionalized as people. I think that journalists become institutionalized. You know, I'm not saying that I'm special, but I don't think there are many journalists that could go and create a content company, right? And I think that you become institutionalized, you're either one thing or the other. And I think that what my children will become is probably a number of things over the course of their careers. They might even have two or three careers, you know. And I don't think that, you know, the argument's made, and it's a strong argument, that university is preparing the next generation for nothing, because the jobs that they're going to be doing in 10, 15, 20 years' time won't even exist. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. But I think that creativity will be the heart of any success in the future. As you mentioned, artificial intelligence. And so I want my kids to be a number of things, like those, the talk I gave at Google. You know, a room full of diverse, multilingual individuals from different backgrounds. I think they've got quite a good, I can't speak for Google, the human resources department, but I think that the people that I met there, I was very impressed with their backgrounds. They're diverse. And I think they weren't looking for MBA students. They were looking for multicultural candidates and my kids are classic Third Nation. One was born in Delhi. My son was born in Delhi. My daughter was born in Cape Town. So I think that they already have these tools, you know, to adapt to new cultures, to be able to overcome adversity. These are skills that schools can't give them. And I want them to have a social conscience. And I think that's something that they, by osmosis, they pick up every day, because we constantly, like, you know, talk about politics. We constantly talk about social issues, much like yourself, constantly navel-gazing and assessing the world around us.
Okay. I mean, certainly from having met you and Navdeep and your charming children a couple of years ago, you know, I think they're going to be well placed for dealing with the uncertainty of the upcoming century.
Yeah, but I think one thing I want to say is that the challenge that I face is making them angry. And that's the one thing that I worry about. It's like, so if, you know, I was giving a talk last year, giving a lecture, and one of the students started crying during the lecture because of one of the stories I was describing. And then, you know, during the Q&A, one of the students put her hands up and says, "Why are you so angry?" And, you know, maybe listening to this podcast and understanding the background, the stories, or where I come from, there may be some sort of, I hate to use the word empathy, but an understanding of maybe why I do sound so pissed off. But what about my kids who are privately educated, who live in relative luxury and have a nice life? You know, where's their anger going to come from? Where's the hunger going to come from? And that's the challenge that I face as a father or as a parent, and Navdeep faces as a mother, is how can we make them angry enough to, because they have the principles, right? Where's that anger going to come from?
I suppose you risk leading them into a world of complacency and a feeling of privilege, and you don't, that's the last thing you want.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Well, maybe that's a follow-up. Maybe a couple of years down the line, let's just see how they're growing up. I want to finish off with some quick-fire questions, relatively quick-fire questions. What principles do you stand by, Dan?
Pay for newspaper and magazine subscriptions.
That's a good one.
Free journalism is not good. Watch foreign films with subtitles.
What's your favourite?
Well, actually, I just watched Roma.
I haven't seen it yet, but I will be watching it in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, my favourite film of all time is a little bit cliched, but I'll take it on the chin. It's Cinema Paradiso. I love the prodigal son narrative. And I was speaking recently, and I said that my little fantasy was actually not to have grown up in Paisley, but a little Scottish village, you know, somewhere in the Western Isles where I would return home to and have a lock in at a local pub, and everyone would know me, you know, and hey, how are you doing, Danny, and stuff. But you know, it never really happens like that. But Cinema Paradiso is probably chimes with that. Laughter's the best medicine. It may not sound it listening to this podcast or interview, but I do, you know, laugh and principles, put your family first.
Especially not wanting to incite anger amongst a certain side of Glasgow, but obviously you must have had a little chuckle at some point when a certain rival team were demoted.
Yeah, well, actually, one of my best friends, the brilliant journalist, was partly responsible for investigating them. So I was quite proud of him for that.
What hard choices have you had to make that might have been tough at the time, but turned out to have been the right decision in the end?
I think resigning as the Africa correspondent for the Sunday Times is difficult because it's a big job, and you know, not many people leave jobs like that. They'll stay until they're dead drunk or divorced. And I didn't want to do any of those things, so that was a tough decision. It was the right decision.
In true rock star fashion, you ducked out at the top.
I'm not sure about that, but yeah, I think I was probably quite smart, and that was a big decision for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, where do you go to discover new ideas?
Okay, so you know, I run, as I said earlier, you know, I don't run like you, but I'm a decent runner, and I think that I do think a lot. I think very clearly, and I run, I have my best ideas. In fact, often when I run, I'll come back and I'll make notes on my phone of ideas that I've had. I've never really understood how that worked. But
do you listen to anything when you run, or you just got free-minded, taking in the surroundings and the sounds?
I kind of went through a period of listening to podcasts, but I couldn't really concentrate on anything else. You know, my head was too full of noise. And so I listened to Spotify, which, I mean, I have music everywhere. Music's such a big part of my life. I listen to music constantly. When I lived in Cape Town, I did kind of surf a bit and was in the ocean quite a lot. And I found that to be like a balm, you know, for my troubled mind at the time. For discovering new ideas for me is travel. I live in Barcelona, right? I mean, I literally, you know, I'm in the city, and I sit and have the pleasure that I get from sitting in a little tapas bar with a little coffee and just looking at people walking around. Just, I don't know why, it's the most simple pleasure, but I love being in the city, the heart, the cultural heart of the city. The cities get quite a revolutionary heart. It's quite anti-establishment, and that kind of appeals to me. You know, appeals to my Scottish kind of, you know, power to the people, I guess, in some respects. So I get a lot of pleasure, and increasingly I'm finding Barcelona to be quite inspiring creatively.
Do you journal? Do you keep a journal? I mean, you're a journalist, obviously, you write a lot.
I think it's, you know, the beauty of being a journalist is you have this incredible back catalogue of writing, so thousands of articles, you know. But I started recently a process of documenting my experiences and little anecdotes and finding stories, and, you know, I think before the Alzheimer's kicks in. And so I think I'm finding it quite cathartic. For example, I only took a decision recently, you know, certainly in the last year or so, to talk about going into therapy and trying to kind of reconcile some of the things that I've experienced, and I think that's probably because of other people. It's become quite fashionable, hasn't it? It's okay to not be okay, as they say. I mean, even one of my beloved Celtic, you know, like a footballer called Lee Griffiths, has suddenly come out with mental health issues. But although his are slightly complex, they seem to be around gambling and having, I think, three or four children with different women. That's another story. But anyway, but he's having a tough time, and when you realize when players like that are coming out and saying that they're struggling emotionally, and one of the most touching things I saw was the Celtic fans had put out an enormous banner saying, "Lee, it's okay not to be okay." And so you realize when it comes over to the mainstream that we're all having emotional issues in one way or another, you know, then it's probably a really positive thing. In fact, I found out in the course of the last year that a couple of dear friends of mine that I thought were completely impregnable had been through quite intense therapy. So I think it's quite a good thing. I think 20 years ago, it would have been frowned upon. 10 years ago.
I don't think you would have ever had a banner on the stands of Parkhead 25 years ago with that on it.
I know, but look, I mean, I'm so proud of the Celtic fans. I mean, you know, Celtic, you know, we played against Tel Aviv sorry, that's, I think that's me. The Celtic fans campaigned for Palestine, when they were, and they raised £500,000, when they were playing in Israel. So, they've got a good sense of principle. Let's not talk about the IRA songs, though. That's a different thing altogether.
Last couple of questions. How do you keep up with technology? And what couldn't you live without?
So my personal email address is dan.mcdougall@mac.com because I was an early believer. So I don't have dan1234mcdougall@mac.com, etc. I embrace technology early on. But one of the things that you've consistently done is given me quite good tips on technology. I'm probably not that up on it as I should be, but technology for me is physical technology. So having my iPad for my notes and my MacBook and my constantly attached to emails and phones. So I'm connected in that sense. So I'm not a Luddite, put it that way.
What about Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter?
So I'm off Facebook now, on principle. Like a lot of people I know, and I think that's mainly a. It's mainly a response to Mark Zuckerberg, I think. But I think that a character like him turning up and being thankful that they're not being investigated for monopolies, so they're actually being investigated for breaching people's privacy. I think that he's a reason not to be on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. But you are on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm a hypocrite. Yeah, but Instagram for me is quite.
It's a legacy of Kevin Systrom. So I think we can show faith in his vision. So I think that's the premise.
I think Instagram for me is more the photography. I'm obsessed with photography. I work with brilliant photographers. I've been so lucky over the years, and I love seeing people's lives through photographs. I've never really had a. I have journalist friends that go through the organisation, so they get up their numbers up. But I'm just interested in it as an amateur, as a kind of voyeur almost.
And what are you on Instagram if people want to follow you?
I don't even think I can tell you. I don't even know what it is.
I'll put it in the show notes. Okay, finally, there's two final questions. What would your advice be to a kid in Glasgow with seemingly impossible goals or ambitions?
I think that, when I went back to give the talk to my school, I'd actually been encouraged by my wife, Navdeep, who said that, why are you lecturing at Cambridge and you're not even bothering to go home and talk to the kids that go to your school or grew up in the same housing estate as you. And it kind of was quite sobering for me. It made me realise that I wasn't avoiding it, or I'd maybe perhaps, I don't know, I just wasn't considering it, and that's a problem. And it's something that I probably need to address. I think I would say that class isn't a barrier. It can be used as an advantage. I would say be cocky and courageous, but base your self-belief on. It's almost like I like the underdog narrative, if you can base that self-belief that you have on a determination to prove people wrong, I think that's a good start. I think cry at losses, but then recover quickly. Even as a young journalist, I had failures and I remember going to work for the Daily Mail in London, being headhunted, as this kind of young star journalist. And then the news editor at Daily Mail at the time was a bully, and I confronted him after he kicked a chair from under a freelance journalist. You can believe he actually did that in the newsroom, and nobody spoke except me. I stood up and said, "What do you think you're doing?" And then we were at war with each other. And then I tried to punch him at a press awards. There goes my career at the Daily Mail. But then, ironically, I returned to the Mail on Sunday as one of the star foreign correspondents. So I think that the resilience is important. I think, have this resilience. And, one of the other things that I thought was that be conceited as a Scot, right? Be conceited enough to believe that you're playing for your country, that you're representing your community and your family and your country. And that should inspire you to do something that they'll all be proud of. And then I think the most important thing for me is you hold dear the romance of travel. Have adventure beyond your own imagination and that of your peers. Because in my experience, to find the story, you've got to go to the ends of the earth. And as I often say, if the journey hasn't broken you, then you haven't arrived. Don't be a tourist, ever.
And live in the shadow of Tintin.
Well, hairs you never went anywhere.
Okay, so the final question. We want to give away a book. Or books to three listeners with the best comments. What should those books be?
So the books I would choose would be The Road to Oxiana by Robert Byron, which was first published in 1937 and remains, in my opinion, to be the greatest travel book ever written. In fact, it's generally regarded as the first real travelogue, you know, apart from Herodotus. But it's like that first in the modern published era, that real, it's just incredible, incredible journey.
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read it, but I will put it on my list of to-dos for 2019.
And The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles, which I've held dear for many, many years. And it's just the most extraordinary book. And that was published in 1949. And I think that the choice of both of these books is probably relevant, because I think that romantic aspect of how I see travel, and I think maybe in some respects I was born in the wrong era, you know. I love the worlds that both authors travel through, and but Bowles in particular is the most underrated author. And I think this quote from The Sheltering Sky is important to me, is that, you know, Bowles wrote that whereas a tourist generally hurries back home at the end of a few weeks or months, the traveller belonging no more to one place than to the next moves slowly over periods of years from one part of the earth to another. Indeed, he would have found it difficult to tell among the many places he'd lived precisely where it was he'd felt most at home. And I can maybe relate to that. Although I feel at home in Barcelona, I don't really know where home is anymore. It's Scotland, isn't it? It is Scotland. All right. I'll never lose that.
Well, I think I live in New York, and New York is my home, but in my physical home, but I suppose spiritual home is Scotland. And yes, always will be. Well, thank you, Dan. I really appreciate it. I'd just like to finish by saying I've known you for a few years, but thank you for your honesty, your vulnerability in answering questions and exposing how you really feel about the challenges you faced personally and professionally in your life. I think your sense of justice and desire for seeking righteousness marks you out against many journalists that maybe don't go as far as you've gone in seeking the truth. And hopefully with the work you've done inspiring other people, both in your school and in Cambridge, and other people that you meet, we'll see a generation of other journalists that will come on and take the mantle that you've left. But thank you, and I look forward to the next time we can maybe follow up on this and get some more details, because there's a lot of things we could have talked about for hours, but I know the time there. Maybe next time we do this face-to-face in Barcelona. Let's see how it goes. Okay.
All right, mate. All right. Good to talk to you, Mark.
All right. Thanks. I really appreciate the time, Dan. Cheers.
Okay, folks. That's it for this week. If you like the show, please subscribe, and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps more people discover us. Just go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to subscribe and rate. For now, stay curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.